Well, good evening, and thanks for coming. it's good to see you. And yes, we're here to launch Arnander's book. I'll tell you all about Arnander later on.
Not all.
I'll keep some things are best not mentioned. I mean. But I'll just tell you the outline of the evening. So I'll introduce Arnander in full. And then we'll have an interview. I'll interview Arnander. And then we'll have a tea break. And after the tea break, Arnander will read from his the collection which he's come here to launch, which is called The Solitude of Small Doors. And you'll have plenty of opportunities to buy the book. I've got them out there on that table. So they're on sale at a special price of £10. We're doing a special offer. If you buy one book of Arnander's, you have another book free, which is this one. It's called The Heart of Origami. It was published in 2005, and it has many Buddhist poets in it, from this movement and outside it. And I was clearing out my flat a few weeks ago and found a box of them in the bottom of my wardrobe, so I thought it'd be ideal to bring that along and give that away.
If I could just butt in and say that's going to be a collector's item one day, because it's got not just me in, but it's got several other really good poets, like the person now is South Korea's chief poet, Ko-an. Some of his first publication in there, I think.
Yeah.
Plus a few others.
Oh, yes, it's a seminal publication, yeah. And Jane Hirschfield, American Zen poet, Maitreya Bandhu, and many, many others. Yeah, I'll just do some formal things. You probably know where the toilets are, but there's a few down that way, and there's some in the basement. If a fire alarm goes off, it is not a drill, and the main idea is to get out of the building, which we do by that door, probably, unless it's blocked, and then we go by that door. So, anyway, that's that. And I'll introduce Arnander. It's my pleasure to introduce Arnander, because he's an old friend of mine, old in the sense of we've known each other a long time.
And the other sense as well.
We've known each other almost 20 years, and Arnander's been a great inspiration to me, as he has to many people, and a spiritual friend as well as an ordinary friend. He's just taught me a lot about life and the Dharma just by being who he is, and leading the life he does. Because when I first came across Arnander, I was very interested in writing poetry and literature and the Dharma, Buddhism, and I couldn't quite see how I was going to mesh the two together, but Arnander helped me do that and showed me the importance of actually, if you have an inspiration, then take it with you, you need it. And he also showed me the importance of the imagination in practicing a spiritual life. So I owe Arnander an awful lot. I will just go through what I know about his life just briefly. He worked for the BBC many years ago, and then came across the Tree Ratna movement in London, and was ordained in 1968, which makes him the moment the longest standing order member of the Tree Ratna order. So he's been in the order nearly 50 years. In 2018 it'll be 50 years. So he's one of the early people who were ordained into the order, and the only one from the earliest group of people who were ordained who's still around in the order. And he's also a poet. I believe for most of his career in the Tree Ratna movement, he's been a poet. Has written a lot of poetry now, and also fiction. He also founded the Wolf at the Door writing workshops, which are Buddhist writing workshops. And he started that in the late 90s, and that's where I first met him, at one of those weekends or retreats. And he founded those with another man called Manjusra, and they went on for many years, and then suddenly Manjusra very sadly died on a retreat, and Ananda carried on those retreats with leading those retreats with Satchalila. And then subsequently there's a group of Ananda's friends, we've carried things forward, and we're still running the Wolf at the Door retreats, and Ananda has retired, and now he's free to write as much poetry as he likes, and he's certainly been productive. So this volume covers the years 2012 to 2014, and it's the third of a series of collected poems that he's produced. This was published by Windhorse, so that's poems from 1968 to 1998, which was followed by An Average Morning in the Galaxy, which was poems 2001 to 2012. I don't know what happened between 1998 and 2001.
Can't remember that.
And then this volume continues from 2012 to 2014. In the meantime, he's also produced a three-decker science fiction novel, or a philosophical science fiction novel, which is also available. They're all available from is it Lulu website? Yeah. But tonight we've got The Solitude of Small Doors on sale. So, I'm delighted to have Ananda here and do his reading and to interview him. And I've had the wonderful experience of reading through those three volumes consecutively, which I've done over the last 2 weeks. And to my mind, Ananda, I can see him getting incrementally better as a poet as time goes on, and producing miraculous stuff now. And I would say that there's a visionary quality in his work. I don't use that word lightly either. And it's the product not only of his skill as a poet, but of the depth and integrity of his practice over the last nearly 50 years or more. I'd say he's a religious poet. I don't know if I'd agree with that, but a religious poet in the best sense, that he's writing out of his spiritual experience, or the experience of his life, which can be regarded as spiritual, and out of the insights and the questings and questionings that he has along the way. And it reminds me of poets like Ryokan and Blake, even, and Thomas Tranströmer, who are, in that sense, they're religious poets. They're writing from a kind of deep engagement with life and in a spiritual way. So I certainly look forward to hearing him read. And so, without further ado, I now have some questions for him. I've helped him prepare. I have sent him some of these, but some of them will also be surprises, perhaps. So I hope he's on form. So,
wouldn't bet on it.
So the inevitable first question, I'm afraid, Ananda, is when did you first start writing seriously, and what prompted you to become a writer, and why in particular a poet, if you see yourself particularly as a poet?
Well, actually, I didn't strictly start as a poet, as a writer of poetry. I started writing stories when I was very young, which I didn't wish to perpetuate the memory of. But, you know, I poetry came quite a lot later, I think. I was really into things like science fiction, really, first, and I just read everything I could find from science fiction, long before I sort of thought about poetry. So I think that's kind of really gone into my DNA, you know, and stuck there. So whatever I write comes out as science fiction, whether it's prose or poetry. But obviously, what was the other question?
What prompted you to become a writer?
That's a very hard one to answer, isn't it? For a long, long time, I didn't really think about writing as something I could do. But I suppose, two things occur to me. One, I had a very encouraging school teacher in our primary school called Miss Wadsworth. And she was a really nice lady, and she said, he's going to be a writer when he grows up. Very prescient. And she really encouraged me, and you know, I felt valued. You know, when you do these little essays at school and things like that, and you get little gold stars and things. I suppose that was one factor. That was quite early. I mean, that was the beginning of influence, really. Which is quite amazing how these influences stick, really. And I suppose just reading was the other thing. You know, I just started reading. Went to the library, got a bunch of books out and just went through them, basically. And one thing led to another. But poetry came quite late, really. I mean, I did produce books of what I called verses. But I think my first one I did was when I was 8. So... probably quite embarrassed to read that now, but yes, I mean, it's an interesting question. Why poetry? I don't really know, because none of my family are poets or writers, even. You know, I suppose you could say my dad was interested in writing insofar as he was a printer, and he did compose little kind of things for a magazine. About his interest, you know. So yeah, there was a very vestigial kind of or liminal kind of influence there. But we didn't really have any family members at all who were at all barely literate, most of them, I think. And I'm trying to sort of rack my brains for any kind of early possible influence. Because there wasn't, we didn't really have books in the house, you know. Well, I think we had a few of Walter Scott's novels, and the thing that influenced me most. Actually, there were two books that influenced me most. One was Chatterbox, which was a very early Victorian compendium of poetry and stories. And actually, now I think of it, that was a big influence because I absolutely. You know, read that from cover to cover. I think it came out every year, if I remember. It's one of these Victorian things, a double column, large format, double column, very close printed things. And, quite difficult to read, you know. And little line drawings in the middle of the columns and things like that. You all know the sort of thing. And that did... I remember some of those. I think Bush Ranger's Gold was one of them. Just avidly lapped it up. You know, it was all swashbuckling stuff, mysterious things. But I think that actually did influence me quite a lot when I started writing, because some of those images have stayed with me. Yeah. And the other thing was the Eagle comic. And I was... I don't know any of you, probably too young to get the Eagle. Down there, that's right, yes. Yeah. And he was a big influence. And there's the science fiction influence, really. And I loved that, and it was really magical. It sort of brought me into another world and took me out of the humdrum world of North Lancashire school terrible weather. Coal pits and textile mills and all that sort of thing, and it was in colour as well. That's the other thing. Beautiful, really good colour. It was one of the first comics to be illustrated in full colour, actually. And it was a very new process. So,
were there any poets that you read early on that were formative?
Not kind of in my. No, I didn't really read poetry at all until I came to London, really, which was in 63. So I was quite old, relatively. I mean, I suppose there was, now it's coming back. There was one, which was Robert Louis Stevenson, because I was given another book was A Child's Garden of Verses, which is rather beautiful little poems, even now when I read it. You know, they're very evocative, and they scan and they rhyme and they're very magical in their own way. You know, he had that feeling for magic. in childhood. So yeah, that was a big influence. So those three, I think, were probably the influences. Oh, and there was also Browning's Pied Piper of Hamelin as well, which again I had when I was very young. And of course, this isn't poetry, but it was a big influence in stories, which was The Wind in the Willows. Which is a really beautiful story.
It's a very poetic book, isn't it? Actually?
Very poetic. It was Piper at the Gates of Dawn, you know. The Water Rat and all that. They were kind of poets in their own way, weren't they, all those characters, you know. They sort of lived a life of dreaming and fantasy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, it is. And once you decided to become a poet...
Well, I'm not too sure I did.
You didn't? I was going to say, what choices have you made in life which have made you become a poet? And have any of them been difficult choices?
Choices that made me be a poet. I was never conscious of it as a choice. I think I just... A lot of it was very unconscious, you know. These things I've just been telling you about that I read had a subliminal effect, I think, and I just unconsciously copied them. I think one thing I did do, I had an ear for it, and it went in into the unconscious quite deeply, and it sort of came out later on, you know, so it wasn't really a conscious decision. It was a subliminal imbibing of all those kind of influences, which came out inevitably in what I wrote later on.
But when you'd embarked on the course of life, which involved lots of writing, as it were, as a poet, were the choices then you had to make to keep that going? Or to...
Well, I think this is where Banti came in, because he, Sangharakshita, gave me, I think one of the first things he gave me were Shakespeare's sonnets. Oh. And the next thing he gave me was Keats's letters. Mm. So those things together are pretty powerful stuff. And they did have an enormous effect, you know. It was, I suppose I was about 16 or 17 when I first came to London. And of course I did all the bookshops and all that kind of thing and picked things up. But those things that Banti gave me were very, very powerful influences, I think. Mm. Certainly the Keats, I think. That's definitely reading Keats's letters and then obviously going on to his poems set me on that path that, you know, one, this is a calling in a way, you know. I felt it was a calling and I had to follow it up somehow. But even then, I wouldn't say it was a choice. It was something deeper than that. It was something you felt was drawing you into it, you know, and you didn't really have a choice. I mean, it would have been a choice not to do that, in a way. More of a choice, and to sort of pursue a career, which I was doing at the same time, you know, the BBC and all that. But Keats won out.
You've practiced Buddhism for a long time, and you've written for a very long time. Have those two aspects of your life, the spiritual... Let's call them two aspects, the spiritual path and art. Have they ever been in conflict?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. very definitely. I think in what we call the early days now, which were the 60s for me, the early days, was a period of quite deep conflict, because I was really just getting into Buddhism. Hadn't been ordained at that point. I wasn't ordained until 68. But the mid-60s, when I was really getting into Buddhism in like a very eclectic way, because I read people like Christmas Humphreys and Alan Watts and all that, you know, the big names of the day. And they were very, before I met Sangharakshita, these were very strong influences, and particularly the Zen tradition. And I actually met a Zen Buddhist monk called Sochu Suzuki-san, who actually eventually a group I belonged to called Hanyakai brought him to London, and he lived in our house for a while, you know. So that was a pretty strong influence, pretty strong karma. He was absolutely uncompromising. He would get everybody up at 6 o'clock in the morning or 5:30, in the summer, and he'd be out in the garden before any of us were sort of fully dressed, really, sort of doing his exercises and whatever he did out there and chanting and all that. And he was just so completely uncompromising. He knew what it was all about, you know, and he just expected us all to follow him. You know, there were no compromises, no concessions. You know, you had to be there, and he just did these sessions, the meditation, Zen meditation setting, which went on for hours and hours and hours. And he didn't seem to understand that maybe we were finding them quite painful. He just said, "Well, you know, if you want to follow the Dharma, this is what you have to do." And yeah, they just didn't. I mean, the Japanese are funny people. They don't seem to know the meaning of compromise. They just go for it. Anyway, yeah, I did follow him for a while, but then Sangharajita came along in 65, 66, and he started doing classes up at Monmouth Street near Holborn, and I started going to those. So that was when that was a kind of choice I made to follow him rather than the Zen tradition specific. Although I was very continuing, you know, to read different traditions. But the Zen was a very strong influence because the other book I read that got at that time was Three Pillars of Zen, called by Philip Kaplow Roshi. That was very powerful because it kind of, one of those things that just took me over. And this was a whole new way of thinking about life, you know. Every moment you were practicing, you know. And there was absolute, again, you know, it was uncompromising. It was the tradition of koans, you know, where you ask an unanswerable question and then you're interviewed, your master interviews about you about it and gets you to sort of give your answer out of your experience. And of course, whatever you say is wrong. So you just have to go away, try again, and it's still wrong when you come back. And then, you know, 3 years later, now you have it. So that was a very powerful influence. It's hard to say why particularly, because, you know, I wasn't a monk by any means, you know. I wasn't a very good disciple or student. But there was something that really got hold of me, and it was almost like there was another world being revealed, and this is what you do to get in to live in that other world. And it was also that it was that age. I was at that age when I was very open to these very 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 deeply motivating kind of rhythms and energies and ideas.
So you had Keats and you had Zen and you had.
I had Keats and I had Dylan Thomas also, and I had Shakespeare, and I had Zen and I had Sangharajita. Those were my big influences, and luckily Sangharajita really appreciated poetry. He really loved poetry, and he supported me doing that, you know. And I wanted to go away to do poetry retreats, and he said, "Yes, go on and do it, you know, but do it with all your heart. Don't do it half-heartedly." And then I wanted to go up to Sami Ling, the Tibetan centre up in Scotland, with Akong and who was the other man up there?
Trungpa.
Yes, Trungpa Rinpoche. And Bhante encouraged me to do that. You know, there was nothing about, this is my teaching, and it's what you're supposed to be following, so you should stay here and follow my teaching. He really encouraged me to try all these things out and follow them. And I did, you know, and I got a lot out of that. But of course, I realized ultimately they were kind of limited. They were, to a large extent, they were cultural. The Tibetans certainly had a very strong cultural element in their teaching. And I mean, that was very attractive, very seductive. And I, for years after I went to Samueling, I was building 10-foot-high shrines in my bedroom and covering them with thousands of Buddhas and everything you can think of. You know, you do that, don't you? You go to those extremes when you're that age. But I didn't last very long. So there were all these, it was very much a melting pot of these sort of things. So, and I don't think it was a question of making choices, because even, although there was conflict, obviously there bound to be, because there was a conflict even the way you sat in the shrine room, you know, who you face, whether you face the wall or you face the shrine, all that kind of thing. So there's all those things going on. But I think it's a question of finding something which has powerful meaning for oneself. So that these things don't matter ultimately, you know. Main thing is to make the effort in whatever works for you, you know.
I was wondering if now, after all these years of writing poetry and practicing, if you see yourself as any particular kind of poet. So I do recognise the influence of Zen, actually, in your
work. Ah, right, work. That's interesting. Nobody's said that before.
And paradox as well. I mean, you mentioned Zen koans before. There's a lot of paradox in your in your poetry, I think. Do you see yourself as a...
I don't, actually, no. I've always been very allergic to kind of... not quite schools, but following a particular label. And I think a lot of poets are, because I think poets generally don't trust labels. Whether it's poetry or whatever they do, I think, you know, writers really have to be free of labels, or want to be free of labels. And no, I never really ever saw myself as a this poet or a that poet or a Zen poet or even a Buddhist poet, you know, or a romantic poet, you know. Although I was for a time influenced by those things, Keats and Shelley and all the rest, and they obviously influenced my writing. But I didn't never thought of myself as a follower of them, of that school. And like later on, when I began to read the American poets, you know, and the Beats in particular, they influenced me a lot. But I never thought of myself as a Beat poet. That just didn't occur to me, really. It just seemed all a bit irrelevant. And I think I still feel that labels just don't really do it for me at all. I struggle even to call myself a Buddhist, really, if the truth be known. Yeah. So,
There's one poet in particular who has influenced your writing and your life in the last few years, and that's William Stafford.
Yeah.
Would you like to just say a bit about how
Sure. Well, Stafford was introduced to me by Manjushra, who's, as you mentioned, he's died a few years ago. But I knew Manjushra in the very early days in Bethnal Green. And he discovered William Stafford, who is a West Coast American poet. And again, I think Stafford's an allergy to labelling has passed through the lineage, as it were, you know, and I think probably he was very much against being this or that or the other. The thing Stafford very much emphasised is following your own voice, finding your own inspiration and being true to that, and taking it as far as you can. And, I mean, Stafford himself was all kinds of things. He was a conscientious objector in America in the 50s. He was a forest service, worked for the Forest Service in America. So he was very much into nature and what we now would call an environmentalist. You know, he was into all these things, but again, he was free of them at the same time. He was a big enough kind of man and writer to not need the crutch of any of these particular labels. Mm-hmm. And I really admire him for doing that. You know, I think that's a great gift, you know. Mm-hmm. Someone can give you that gift of not needing a crutch not needing to lean on any particular school or partial embodiment of the vision, if you like, because they get in the way, and ultimately they cripple you, really. You can't, you know, if you lean on them, you just become a bit unbalanced, you know. So I think Stafford's legacy mainly was that, not labelling yourself, not limiting yourself by any particular label or school or image. But the other thing that was a great gift from Stafford to me, also through Manjusri as well, was his what he called lowering your standards. Now, we're all very competitive, and we all have these standards that we must keep up to, especially for poets and writers and artists. We have standards to keep up. And Stafford was absolutely against all kinds of that kind of competitiveness, in which saying, is he a better poet than him? You know, is this school that he belonged to is more influential than that school that he belonged to, and all that kind of thing. You just follow your own inspiration and be true to it and listen to it. That's what, you know, he was very, very keen on listening to your own experience, really, and letting your own experience be the guide. He was a great listener, and he said that on several occasions, that listening was incredibly important to him. And you just listen to anything. You listen to the noise of the traffic outside, and you learn something from that. You know, you listen to the noises that individuals make when they're walking around and doing things. You know, and you listen to the noises in your own head and all that kind of thing. You learn such a lot about what, not just writing, but life. You know. So Stafford, yeah, those two things really. Listening to everything, not censoring, not judging, not being judgmental.
Of yourself, including of yourself.
Of oneself, of course, yeah, but of equally of your writing. Yeah. And this is one of his very big points and tenets in his life that he passed on to everyone. Don't judge your writing. Don't say this isn't good enough, because that is just going to inhibit you and cripple you from doing better. What you need at the early stages, when you're just beginning, is to accept everything and welcome everything. He said, if I don't welcome my first attempts, you know, my later attempts may not come at all. The good things may not come at all, because they will feel not welcome. So it makes perfect sense to me. Yeah, so that's, Stafford was a big influence at that. Not early an influence, you know, it was quite late in my life, relatively, but he was a very big influence through Manjusri. And I'm very grateful to Manjusri for bringing him into the movement, because his influence has now spread a long way.
Yeah. You're talking about being open and listening, and I notice there's a lot of very accurate observation in your poetry, and a lot of reflection as well, which of course are, as well as being the values of William Stafford, they're Buddhist values, really. Do you think that being a Buddhist has sort of honed your ability to listen and to be open and to reflect?
Well, I think it probably must have done, although, again, I'm not terribly conscious of that. But, you know, practicing for many, many years is bound to have an effect, even if you do it as badly as I do. You know, you can't help but sort of have some effect and change you in some way. And I think it has made me listen to things a lot more. Yeah. And of course, you listen to your own mind in meditation. Whatever kind of meditation you do, you think you've got to listen to your own mind. I think that's one of the crucial things, that whatever label you put on it, you know, that's what you have to do. Listen to what's going on. Take notice of what's going on. Don't push it to one side and ignore it. And of course, in writing as well, that's what you must do. You know, notice what's happening. When you write something, what's happening in your mind? And when you write a certain image, how does it change what you see? And how do images, once they're written on the page, relate to each other and affect, interact with each other? So all this is going on a subliminal kind of level.
I've been interested to see, reading through these three volumes of poetry that I've read of yours, your own voice developing over the years, and it seemed to me that in the first few poems it wasn't quite there. There were sort of experiments and there were other people's voices, and then your voice would come in and then vanish again for a bit and then come forward and sort of become stronger as the poems went on. Did you consciously work at, I mean, and I see your voice as quite quirky and loving paradox and quite surreal and full of humour, but under the humour is a lot of seriousness and depth. Did you work consciously at developing your own voice, or did that come?
No, definitely not. No, again, it was all subliminal, really. Voice is a very strange thing. It's a very elusive thing. And it's like a bit like a kind of deva, really. It gives you a lot of teaching, but it doesn't do it very directly. And it's very devious in the way it teaches. But it is absolutely crucial that you find it and know it and listen to it when you do find it. And some people never do that. You know, I think it has to be said, some people don't get to that stage. Some people, it takes a long, long time, but they do get there eventually. Some people seem to get it very early. I think Keats probably got his voice very early. Dylan Thomas probably did. I would presume Shakespeare did as well. he couldn't have written what he wrote without it. But the conditions which create one's voice and shape it and determine its effect is very mysterious. It is very important, and I think one should think a lot about the voice. The kind of things that it does well. But I think it's determined by almost everything that happens to you. You know, like the voice of my father, and I mean his literal voice, you know, the way he talked, is very much in me, you know, and has been passed on to me subliminally as well as explicitly, just because I've been around him for so long. And to perhaps a lesser extent, my mother. I'm less aware of her voice. But certainly his voice, I can hear it very, very distinctly. And I learned a lot from that. But again, it's not conscious. It's not. I couldn't tell you what I learned. Yeah. You know. And of course, my teachers, all my school teachers and that. So, yeah.
Because there must have been a phase where you began to trust it more, although it came through organically.
Yeah, but that was quite late, I think. Yeah. I think it was quite late when that happened. I wasn't aware of it for many, many years, even after I started writing. I would like to say, I mean, as you said, it came and then it went away again and then it came back. And it's hard to know, really, when one's found it, because it's not a conscious process. It doesn't reveal itself in a cloud of glory, you know. It goes very, very quietly and silently. Kind of lurks past in the shadows. But I think also, I think probably Lancashire has something to do with it as well, the culture of Lancashire. Certainly the weather, I think, has a lot to do with one's voice as well, yeah. Because I admit I'm a great pessimist, generally. And that's, my voice is part of that as well. I think weather has a lot to do with it. And cold and damp and gloom, you know, tends to influence one a lot, because you are subjected to it from the moment that you're born, if not before even.
It's funny, I was going to come on to that, because you say you're a pessimist, but another thing I've noticed in reading these three volumes is that there is, I don't know if it's pessimism, but a kind of knowledge of the gritty side of life in many poems. In the later volume, to me there seems a lot of optimism, actually, a lot of light and a lot of appreciation of life, and particularly of the possibility of understanding and opening and things like positive things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It just seems to come in quite powerfully in a lot of poems. I hope you'll read them and we'll see, but that struck me. And I'm wondering if there's anything that's... has something happened to you to bring that in this...
Well, I'm actually very suspicious of that voice, that positivity, for obvious reasons, after just what I said, but because that earlier voice is quite... Well, I won't say negative, I don't like the word negative. It has negative connotations, but... I am a bit suspicious of the what shall we call it, the spiritual voice, I suppose, because it's so easy to counterfeit it, to kind of assume it. At the same time, these are the two poles, aren't they, for which a writer has to struggle in a way. At the same time, the opposite one, the gloomy, pessimistic, world-weary voice, is very prevalent and can easily swell, override all the other voices. And again, I don't like to give way to that either, because that's not authentic either. So you've got this bit of kind of drama being played out between the original voice, if you like, the gloomy, the inherited voice, the voice that comes from one's early days and early environment, and then you've got this new voice, let's call it a new voice, which tends to be more light and more in the head, and more optimistic, and more sort of yes, we can do it sort of thing. Yes, we can. I distrust both of them now. You see, so that's the difficulty. I think the voice, in a way, comes from the struggle to integrate both of those two things.
Can I just ask a question? Sorry about it. We're just passing by, and we're enchanted with the whole lot.
Go ahead. Yes.
Do you feel that is a gift?
What?
That voice. Or do you feel that the work is all yours, or is something that goes through you?
That's a good question, yes. That is a good question. My actual experience is that it's something that comes through me that I don't have much control over.
Right.
It's something that, it's almost like I'm a radio receiver. And it's in the air, and I'm picking it up from the air.
So you do, yeah.
And I'm a channel for it. But, of course, that has other connotations, of not very good connotations as well. But, that is my experience, if I'm honest, that it is it is something that I pull out of the air, and it goes through me and comes out of here.
And I call it a gift.
You can call it a gift, yes, that's right. That's, but it's not something I have much control over. I can't say what comes through.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
I mean, I can try, but generally it either comes or it doesn't, and it has to have its say, sort of thing. Yes, it has to be said. Some poems come very, very pure, in a very pure way, from that bigger voice, that inspiration. Some poems come without any change, without any modification, and they come onto the page without very much difficulty or redrafting or anything. They're just boom, they're there, and that's finished the poem, and that is a gift, obviously, when that happens, because I don't have anything to do with it. I'm just opening myself to something bigger. But there are not many poems come like that. The great, maybe only a dozen in my whole career, writing life, have come in that way. And all the other hundreds of them have come through struggling to get the right words onto the page, which can take weeks or months or years. Some poems take years. And I'm never quite sure which are the better poems. The poems that just come like that, as divert from the divinity, straight onto the page, sort of thing, and you don't have much to do with it. You're just a hand, really, sort of writing it. Like the old idea of the
muse.
And the muse, which I think is a very valid sort of image for the poet, even now when muses are not in fashion. But the other kind of poem is the struggle, which takes a heck of a lot of energy and time and effort and pain, but maybe that produces a better poem. I don't know. Who can tell? That's for someone else to answer.
Well, I think that's a good place to end that interview. So thank you for your question.
Very interesting good question.
One. Yeah. And thank you, Ananda. And so we'll have a tea break now.
Great.
Well, to say tea break, actually, it's a juice break. We haven't got any tea. But,
you can't have tea. There. It's a Buddhist centre.
I just wanted to thank you again for coming here, because we were discussing this earlier, but we are competing with Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. It's Shakespeare's birthday, 400 years, and there are lots of events going on all over London, so Anders is very lucky to have you here. So, deserves a good audience, but yeah. Anyway, so do enjoy your juice, and there's an opportunity to buy Amanda's book there. And as I said, if you buy the book, you get one book free, and that's this one, full of lots of other Buddhist poets. Thanks.
Good. Thank you. Good question. Did you ask?